It's Friday, July 28th, 2006. You're moving at the speed of creativity with Wesley Fryer, narrowcasting from Wichita, Kansas. Well, good evening and welcome to a first podcast of several sorts. First of all, this is a podcast that I'll be sharing from the MTI 2006 conference, and that conference is the Mid-America Technology Institute, hosted by MACE. And MACE is an organization here in the state of Kansas that is really the state-level technology conference for K-12, and it is the Mid-America Association for Computers and Education. And I was fortunate to have an opportunity to attend that this week and also present a couple sessions today at the conference. So this will be the first of several podcasts from the conference, and this one is being shared with permission by Will Richardson. And Will was the keynote speaker for the conference, and the title of his presentation was A Web of Connections, Why the Read-Write Web Changes Everything. And I would assume, but maybe falsely, that most of you are familiar with Will Richardson. And if you're not, you certainly should be, because Will has the blog WebBloggedEd and is, I think, most likely considered to be the most authoritative blogger in the blogosphere right now for education, because so many people have linked to Will, and he has been doing blogging in the education space for so long. He said in a session he'd been blogging for about 5 years and started when there were only, you know, a handful, maybe less than 10 edubloggers that were actually out there blogging. So if you go to a search tool like Technorati and you look for Will Richardson's blog, you will see that he has a lot of folks who have linked and are linking to him. And that's one of the two ways that you actually sort Technorati posts, is either by freshness or date, or you sort by what is called authority. And certainly if you look at my blog and probably anyone else who has been in conversation with Will through the blogosphere, you'll probably see his name as the first one that pops up if you sort by authority. Before we do that, though, I would like to do a quick shout-out to Pam at ESDAC. And ESDAC is, like what we have in Texas, as an educational service center. It's an educational service unit there in Hutchinson, Kansas. And Ron at the conference asked me to give you a shout-out, Pam. I'm really happy and I guess really honored that so many people have been tuning into the podcast, because it was really neat at the MACE MTI 2006 conference to meet folks that I had never met face-to-face but said they had been listening to my podcast or reading the blog for some time. And anyway, just really felt like they kind of knew me because of things that they had read and written. So I'd like to encourage you to actually give me a shout-out. And if you go into the iTunes program and go into the iTunes podcast directory, you can either do that by clicking podcasts and clicking the link for podcast directory, or finding the podcast directory inside the iTunes music store, you can actually link to my podcast, Moving at the Speed of Creativity, and give me a shout-out. I learned recently that it's possible to comment inside the iTunes Music Store and the podcast directory, and that would be really cool to get a shout-out from you wherever you might happen to be on planet Earth, and let me know where you are and maybe what you do, and if you want to, what kinds of things that you enjoy most about the podcast or things that you would like to hear more about. So, without further ado, we're going to go ahead and start the podcast, but I will comment that another first is that I am using a new podcasting program that I am very enthused about, and it is called Ubercaster, and it is by a German company, and as many of you may know, if you're into podcasting yourselves, there are several different choices for tools, and I have really fluctuated between using Audacity, which is a free open source software program, a great program that runs on the Windows side, it runs on Mac, it runs on Linux. And I've really used that to create the lion's share of my podcast. But I've also used GarageBand, because I use a Macintosh predominantly, and that's a great tool. But GarageBand was designed pretty much to create music, and in its latest iteration, GarageBand 3, it is a lot more friendly towards podcasting. But this Ubercaster really looks like a fantastic tool, and I can see that I may end up using this primarily because it allows me to prepare, record, cut, and even release multiple versions of a podcast simultaneously, which you cannot do in GarageBand, where I can actually create an MP3 version and an enhanced version. So anyway, this will be the first of several podcasts from the MTI 2006 conference. Alas, thank you to David Warlick for creating the wonderful Hitchhiker resource and tool that allows people to track Flickr pictures, blog posts, and other kinds of tagged items that are coming from conferences. And I'll include in the podcast show notes not only links to Will's resources, but also the wiki that we created and worked on at the MTI conference, as well as the Ubercaster link if you're interested in checking that out.
It's great to be in Kansas. This is my second trip here. I was here 25 years ago as the best man at a wedding in Topeka, believe it or not, in the middle of summer in a tuxedo. That was not a very fun occasion. Everybody sweat through their tuxedos. Actually, one of the grooms, or one of the best men, passed out during the middle of the wedding. So yesterday when I got off the plane, I had this kind of flashback to Topeka about 25 years ago. And there was a thundercloud that followed us on the plane, I swear to God, all the way from Houston down here. And then when I got in the car to drive down here, it followed me down the road. So I was a little bit concerned about that. But it is great to be here. And I just want to compliment the organizers of this conference for putting two bloggers as the kind of the spotlight speakers. Wes, just so you know, you don't have to take any notes for the presentation. He's probably blogging it live as we speak. And also, he's got his little iRiver up here recording the whole thing, which he's going to turn into a podcast. So this is the way things work now in this new world where information is really easy to access. I do want to talk a little bit about technology today, obviously, but I don't think that technology is really the main thing that's happening these days as much as it is, in a changing world, the imagination that we need to have when using technology. And so what I want to do is, first, I just want to talk about a couple of examples of how people are using technologies very creatively now, and kind of move into a discussion about how we can take some of these new technologies that are out there like blogs and wikis, and really start to implement them in our classrooms in interesting ways. So I want to start by talking about One Right Paperclip. How many of you know the story about One Right Paperclip? Okay, a couple of you do. So this is Kyle MacDonald, and about a year ago, he said, well, I'm going to start a blog, and I'm going to take One Red Paperclip, and I'm going to put it on the blog, and I'm going to start trading that up and see what I can trade for it until I get a house, free and clear, within 1 year. That was his goal. And a lot of people were like, yeah, well, sure, that's really going to happen. But he put it up there, and actually he made a trade first for a pen that looked like a fish, which probably someone just gave it to him as a lark. But someone liked that because they gave him a doorknob that looked kind of strange. So he put that up on his blog, and he traded that actually for a Coleman stove. So it wasn't a great Coleman stove. It wasn't brand new, obviously, but it was much better than One Red Paperclip, obviously. And someone really wanted the Coleman stove because they traded that for a generator, which worked fairly well. But, obviously you can see it wasn't great. But someone really wanted the generator because they traded that for a party keg. And I love the little sign down there, I owe you a keg full of beer. I love that. Well, someone really wanted the party keg because they traded Kyle on his blog a snowmobile for that party keg. Now, I don't know if they used the party keg before or after they traded the snowmobile, but anyway, he got a snowmobile out of that, and he put that up on his blog, and he said, who's going to give me something for a snowmobile? And someone from Yak, Canada, wrote in and said, I'll give you a week in Yak for the snowmobile. And this is up in British Columbia, somewhere up by the Arctic Circle, where I guess they do a lot of snowmobiling. So someone said, sure, I'll take that trade. So he put the Yak vacation up there, and he traded that for a cube truck. Someone gave him that, so he had that up on his blog now, and he traded that for a $10,000 professional recording contract at a studio in Toronto. Now, at some point, people are probably seeing this and going, this is a great marketing opportunity, right? I can get some headlines, and I can make these trades. But there was a woman in Phoenix who had always wanted to cut a record, never had the opportunity to do such. So she said to Kyle, I will give you 1 year free in my apartment in Phoenix. Free and clear, and he made that trade, and so he was close to getting a town, so he had at least a year's rent. Now, this is where he kind of went south a little bit, because he traded this for an afternoon with Alice Cooper. And not a lot of people really understood why he did that. But he then traded that for a Kiss, kind of a Kiss, you know, band, remember the band Kiss? Snow Globe type of thing. So people were like, what are you talking about? But actually, there's the little Kiss Snow Globe. But actually, if you recognize, that's Corbin Berenson, who used to be on L.A. Law, for those of you who are my age and probably remember him. But he was making a movie, and he said, well, I'll trade you a speaking part in my movie for that Kiss Snow Globe. And he made that trade, and he put that up on his blog, and guess what? The next trade he made? A house in Kipling, Saskatchewan, free and clear. Now, Kipling wanted some notoriety, and they had this old house, but it had been restored. But anyway, they're having a big party. They're having the biggest housewarming party in the history of the universe. If you email Kyle and show up at Kipling during Labor Day, in the first weekend in September, you can take part in this party and welcome him into his new house that he started with just one red tape cord. Pretty amazing. And not something I think that we could have done or that he could have done either, even a couple years ago, even 2-3 years ago. But the fact that he could get an audience so quickly, the fact that he could get so much transparency for his ideas, I think changed it. So this is about imagination. One more example. You know what anime is? Kind of the Eastern cartooning kind of video type of thing. There's a site online called Anime Music Video, which is pretty interesting because people, lots of kids in fact, do mashups there. And a mashup is kind of a new verb for taking two different types of media and putting them together in new and interesting ways. So what kids will do and what people will do is they'll take videos, these anime videos, and they'll put music, they'll put other types of music or audio on them, and they'll come up with things like this.
If you'll kindly step up to the parapet, I'll give you a lesson in marksmanship.
You couldn't give me a lesson in long-distance spitting. Anything you can do, I can do better. I can do anything better than you.
No, you can't.
Yes, I can.
No, you can't.
Yes, I can.
No, you can't.
Yes, I can. Yes, I can.
I was writing paper on the PC, and it was like beep 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 beep, and then like half of my paper was gone, and I was like, It devoured my paper. It was really good paper, and then I had to write it again, and I had to do it fast, so it wasn't as good. It's kind of a bummer. I'm Ellen
Feist,
and I'm a student.
All right, so that's the type of thing we're talking about. We're talking about the ability not only to create that type of thing, but also to publish it in very imaginative ways. So imagination, when you look it up in the dictionary, basically says the ability to confront and deal with reality by using the creative power of the mind and resourcefulness. And basically the reality these days for many of us, I think, is the web. Especially for educators, especially for technologists, it seems that more and more everything is moving to the web and moving actually away from desktops and hardware types of things that we're used to. 1 billion people are on the web right now. 1 billion was supposedly a 24-year-old woman from Shanghai who, according to the demographics, was the 1 billionth person to plug into the web. And there will be another billion by 2015. 2 billion people out there who are interacting in ways that are very, very interesting now, very different from the ways we could interact even a couple of years ago. 10 billion web pages, let's get really overwhelmed. 1 trillion links on the web right now, some places where you can click. It's an amazing number when you think about it. The emerging reality, however, is not just this web, basically this one-way web where we read information and we take information from it, but it really is this read-write web, because now it's becoming very easy to write information to the internet. You don't need to know code, you don't need to know HTTP, you just need to know a few simple tools that will allow you to start creating and start publishing. A lot of people are calling this Web 2.0, and there are other names for it. But it is easier to create, it is easier to publish, and Tim O'Reilly, who is a technology book publisher, said this at a commencement about a month ago. And it's a little bit of hyperbole, I think, maybe, but really, I wouldn't be surprised if 20 years from now we look back at this period right now, the beginning of the 21st century, and say, look at what happened in these 5 or 10 years. Look at the shifts that happened because of our ability to connect in these ways, because of our ability to publish and to create in easy ways. There are 50 million blogs out there right now. There's more than one being created every second, 70,000 new blogs every day. People are out there creating content. 1.2 million new posts every day, 7 million new web pages every day. If you're feeling overwhelmed, that's the point. There's a lot of information out there. There's a lot of things that people are creating and putting out there. 2.7 billion links. And if you really want to understand the blogosphere, which is kind of the word, the name for it, go to technorati.com because they kind of track what's happening and they'll give you all sorts of search tools and everything else. So while the web has always linked pages, meaning, you know, we can click one page and go to another page, what's happening now is that we're really linking ideas. We're really linking what people are creating and the ideas that they have around it, conversations that people are having about those ideas and people. We really are able to connect to one another now in ways that we haven't in the past. And so it's not just linking of content. It's really linking of much, much more interesting types of things. So people are obviously calling this period, all sorts of things, society of authorship, you know, era of collaboration. Tom Friedman, who wrote The World is Flat, which is a pretty good book if you want to get your brain around some of the stuff that's happening here. Basically, I like what he calls us. He calls us uploaders, that we are this generation of people now, or this society of people, global society, that can upload content and upload information in a very easy way. So it's very active. It's very participatory. This is not consumption. This is not just, you know, receiving information. You need to be engaged with this web and with the stuff that's happening here. Lawrence Lessig, who's really one of my heroes in all of this, he wrote a book called Free Culture, which is free online. He also started a site called creativecommons.org, which is an amazing site that's attempting to give content producers the rights and the copyrights to their own work in different ways. You know, he says, we still don't realize how significant this might be. This might be a huge shift in the way that we look at things. Now, for us, I think personally, it's extremely, extremely important. It's extremely significant. You know, I used to not be proud of the fact, well, I won't say I wasn't proud of it, but I didn't say very often that I was a blogger, you know. But I am a blogger first. I really am. I have been blogging for 5 years on my site. And I will tell you that I have learned more from being a blogger than I have from any educational experience, any traditional educational experience that I've ever had collectively put together, you know, in one place. Blogging has taught me more about myself, taught me more about education, technology, people, the world. It is a place that I go to and really learn every day when I have the time, which is not as often these days. But still, it's a place that I have really spent a lot of intellectual capital and gotten multitudes in return, even, you know, just great amounts of learning in return. So there are 69,000 education-related blogs out there right now. When I started, there were about 7, literally. I could find only a handful of people who were talking about these technologies in 2001. Now 70,000, which is really very cool. 25 million kids creating content online already, and I don't think that's including MySpace, which we'll talk about a little bit later. So it is about imagination, and kids are creating this stuff. They're already doing it, and I want to give you a couple of examples of this. I just want you to listen to Matt Bischoff, who was one of the first podcasters in the entire world, actually, in 2004. This is, just take a listen to Matt. And listen, tell me what you hear when you hear Matt speak in this podcast.
Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to Escape from the World with your host, Matthew Bischoff.
This is Escape from the World for Thursday, November 4th, 2004, and I am your host, Matthew Bischoff, from MatthewBischoff.com. For more information about podcasting or the iPodder client, just visit iPodder.org, and for more information about this show, just visit the homepage at MatthewBischoff.com. This is a podcast about technology, which features technology news, a site of the night, and other items of interest. My name is Matthew Bischoff, a 13-year-old from New Jersey, podcasting from my bedroom. And thanks for listening to this edition of Escape Radio.
So I always love that last part, right? Podcasting from my bedroom. I always wonder, you know, why did he feel compelled to even say that? Why did he add that? Why did he make that decision to add that? And I think the answer is pretty simple. It's because he could. You know, because he is. Because it's that easy for him. And what do you hear in his voice? Excitement, energy, enthusiasm. He wants to teach you something about technology, doesn't he? We have a sight of the night. We have news about technology. This is not for grandma and grandpa. This is not for the kids around the block, right? This is for an audience that he has no idea who they are. But he has something to give to them. He has something to share back to them. And this has been a vehicle for him to do that. And Matt is still podcasting, not quite as often, but I'm sure he's still in his bedroom, too. I'm sure he's still doing it from wherever he is on the road. This is my daughter, Tess. And even though she's not the greatest speller in the world, she does have a lot of, I think, interesting ideas. And so when she had to do a weather project, she said, I want to do a weather recipe book where if you want to get a tornado, here are the ingredients, here's how you mix them up, and here's how, you know, here's how it gets created. And I thought, well, that's a great idea. So she went ahead and she did that book. And what we did was we scanned it in and we put it up on the site called Flickr, which is an online photo sharing site where people are posting literally tens and tens of millions of pictures of all different sorts of things. And Flickr's kind of cool because you can put the stuff up there and you can show it as a slideshow. So if we wanted to just take a look at Tess's book, we could just kind of watch the pages kind of go through. And Tess was really proud of this. And I love that, you know, that plan ahead sign, you know, right there it is, right? The table of contents and just a cute little picture of her in the snow here that I think is so cute. There she is. But the cool thing is that Flickr will tell you how many people have looked at a particular photo or a particular set. And when you come down here, we can see now that is 1,105 people have looked at Tessa's book. And I'll own about 100 of those. So really it's about 1,000 people who have come to see Tessa's book, people who she doesn't know. And guess what? She wants to know how many people have read her book. She wants to know if people are looking at it, and it motivates her to write. She's a blogger now. She doesn't blog real often, but she blogs about, she's reading the Lemony Snicket books now, so she's starting to blog about those. She blogs about her horse. My son, who's 6, is a blogger. He blogs about aliens. And my wife is a blogger. She blogs about the environment. It's kind of the curse of my family. You know, we all have to be bloggers. But still, there's that audience thing that happens there. This is just one more example. This is Sandeg Primary School outside of Glasgow in Scotland. I love this. This is their homepage. Everything on their homepage is created by kids. All of it. Pictures, videos, podcasts, the entries here. How many of you have schools where everything on the school homepage is created by your kid? Good. That's great. Not many. But we can do that now. Why wouldn't we do that? I mean, this is great stuff. They have all sorts of things going on here. They have kids writing the essays or little posts that go along with it. You know, here's by Natasha and things. So it's easy. It's easy for kids to do this. And they take this very seriously. They have an audience. They have a purpose for the work that they're doing that goes far beyond the classrooms, far beyond the things they're doing in the schools. So they are teaching as well. Just an example here. This is a collaboration I did between my journalism students a few years ago and a fourth grade class. I had high school. A fourth grade class in Georgia. And my kids taught them journalism through the use of blogs. Basically, they mentored each other. They created lessons. Those are the kids down in Georgia. And there's a picture of my kids down here. And here are the lessons that they did, the mini lessons and things. And they had a real audience. They had a real purpose. And they were teaching. And you all know, if you really want to learn something, what's the best way to do it, right? Have to teach it, without question. So my kids became teachers. And I connected them with a group of kids who wanted to learn. And it was a great experience for all of them. It was a real interesting experience. Certainly, there were some things that went along with it that were worth a lot of thought. But it was great. And so they're learning as well. They're building networks. They're going far beyond our classrooms with the networks that they're building already. And I really do believe it's just different. This is a different place. We're in a different world. And we really have to start thinking differently about what we can do in the classroom. Kids know it too. This is an exam answer on a test that was given by an edu-blogger named Clarence Fisher up in Canada. And I love that line. You don't need to be some rich person in New York. You can produce it from your own home. I always wonder what that vision was of those rich people in New York who were creating all the content. And it's also changed how we can learn in today's society. So the kids understand it. The kids know that there's something happening. So leveraging this read-write web is really not about the technology, because the technology is not that difficult. It's really not. It is instead, I think, about imagination. How can we take these technologies into the classroom, into our schools, into our practice, and really implement them in ways that change the equation, that really change what we're doing in the classroom. It's literally about thinking out of the box. We can't keep thinking of our classrooms as four walls any longer. Now, I think this has really big implications for us, and I'm just going to go through about six or seven that I kind of see out there and talk through a number of them. So the first is, this environment really changes the way we can learn. And it does so because for a number of reasons, but the primary reason is because now we have access to a lot of knowledge, to a lot of content. We've gone for 100 years thinking that schools needed to be the place where we get kids together to give them content because access to content was very limited, very restricted. But it's not any longer. So when knowledge is scarce, which is where we've been for the last 100 years, this is what learning looks like. This is what it is. Kids in rows, posters on the walls. A friend of mine said, I mean, kind of a joke, although it's kind of a sad joke, but he said, you know, now that all the glaciers are melting because of global warming, what if there 100 years ago had been a teacher that had been frozen into the ice and been melted out now and went back to her classroom or his classroom and walked in? Do you think that teacher would be able to teach? Pretty much. Probably. Wouldn't it be too difficult for that teacher to navigate around that space and figure out what was going on? But that's what it looks like when we have a scarcity of content. But when knowledge is abundant, when we have access to a lot of knowledge, this is what learning looks like. This is MIT OpenCourseWare. Have you seen this site? Amazing site. You go here, MIT has put up 600 classes, over 600 of its classes online, in aeronautics, anthropology, whatever you want, pretty much. If you look down the left here, you can see all the different ones, economics, history. And what happens is, when you go and you look at some of these classes, like let's take biology, for example, you can take all of these classes here, graduate courses as well, undergraduate courses. I'll just pick one, the intro to biology. If you take this course, you get the syllabus, the calendar, the readings, the recitations, the assignments, the exams, and the answers, by the way, not just the questions, study materials, discussion guide, and every video lecture or audio lecture that that professor gave while giving that course. That's amazing. Now, that isn't the case. The video and audio part isn't the case for all of the courses, but think about that. Think about that. If you had a group of motivated, friends or kids or whatever else, and maybe found a mentor of some type, you could go and almost get an MIT education for free. So that type of content is out there, and it's growing and growing. We can learn anything, anywhere, anytime these days, almost. Call it ubiquitous learning, right? Because learning is everywhere if we are connected. We are ubiquitously connected, and if we are, I love this quote, ubiquitously connected and pervasively toxic. What that means is basically, when we get to the point where we are ubiquitously connected, and we will be at some point, if you live in Philadelphia, it's coming sooner rather than later. They're putting a wireless cloud over the whole city. So wherever you are, you can get access. When we are ubiquitously connected, we are always pervasively proximate, meaning always close to the information that we need. Always close. Just a quick example of that. When we were going to a conference, I brought my family to a conference I did last week up in Boston. And my daughter had kind of blown out her flip-flop, broken her shoes, so we needed new shoes. So as we were driving up, I took my cell phone out. I have a Trio, and we text messaged shoe stores, Newton, Mass. And then we sent it to 46645. Now, 46654. We just texted. Anyone know what 46654? G-O-O-G-L? Okay. In 30 seconds, the phone rings with a listing of all the shoe stores in Newton, Mass. Phone numbers with a link that I can just click on and get. Addresses, times, all that stuff. So that's it. When we have access to information like that, we are always close to the information that we need. If I wanted to get a pizza in Winfield last night, I could have just done the same thing. Pizza, put in the zip code, all the pizza places, phone numbers, addresses, everything else would have come up. And these are the tools. This is what's coming. This is the Origami Project, the one over here, right? The one that Microsoft is trying to put out, the basically pocket tablet PC that will be able to connect, if there's access from anywhere. But there are others. You can do this with your phone. Kids do this with their phones already. So the learner can decide. The learner decides what, when, where, and how she learns, right? Now, how is that different from our classroom? Well, we try to timestamp when kids are going to learn physics. Or at least when 25 of our kids are going to learn physics. right? These 25 kids are going to learn physics at this particular time during this part of the year. How do we do that? How do we find those 25 kids that are ready to learn physics during that particular time, during that part of the year? Great data-driven decision-making, huh? We know something. No, we don't know. We kind of just take a chance that those are kids that are going to get together. So we group them based on proximity, right? We group them based on geography. But when the learner can decide what, when, where, and how she learns, it changes. It goes from just-in-case learning to just-in-time learning. How much of the stuff that you learn in high school was taught to you just in case you need it? Right? And you understand why. Because, again, we didn't have access to a lot of content. So here are the things that we've decided that are most important for you to know just in case you need to know it. Why now? If we have access, if we have an abundance of knowledge, isn't it just in time? Isn't it, how can I find the information I need when I need it? Right? That's the difference. That's the shift. It's nomadic learning. I'm a nomadic learner. I graze on knowledge, basically. I go out on the web and I just take, go where I need to go. I follow threads that are of interest to me. And when I need information, I go find it. I don't learn things. I don't say, well, today I'm going to learn physics on the web when I'm reading physics, just in case next week I need to know physics. If I need physics, I go find physics. I go to my network. So when we connect around affinity, interest, right? When we connect around interest in terms of learners instead of around geography, which is what we're doing now, learning looks like this, which is Wikipedia, right? Now we have in Wikipedia over a million articles. Million, what is it, 1.2 million, something like that now, if it comes in, there we go, 1.279 million articles, where people are learning and creating content because of the things that they are interested in, shared interests that they have. Hopefully that'll come in. And if you haven't looked at Wikipedia, you know, you need to. Wikipedia is kind of the poster child for internet collaboration. The reason that we need to know Wikipedia, however, is because, like it or not, Wikipedia is becoming a very popular site on the internet. So these are the trend lines. Wikipedia is in blue, New York Times is in red. So whether we like it or not, Wikipedia is definitely something that we have to learn to deal with, because now it's coming up first on Google searches as well, if you haven't noticed already. A lot of Wikipedia entries are coming up first. And we're also going from do your own work now, right, to work with others. This is an environment that is extremely collaborative. Extremely expected that we are working with others when we create content. And I love this kind of this little cartoon where it says, I'll collaborate with my peers from around the world at the top versus you will collaborate with your peers in the classroom. Right? How different is that? I think it's a really important shift. You know, Dewey has risen in this world, right? Learning is a social process. That's what he used to say. And there's another guy, George Siemens, who I think is doing some really interesting thinking about learning now. And he says, well, learning is also a network process. Building networks. It's finding out who the people are that you can trust and that you can use. So this is my network. And I'm there in the middle, that little weblog ed thing, that's my blog. And there's George Siemens. And there's Ann Davis in Georgia. And that's Barbara Ganley in Vermont. And that is Conrad Glogowski in Canada. And that's Bud Hunt in Colorado. And he's in Wes is probably up there somewhere. If he's not, he should be. And so this is my network. These are the people I learned from. This is my network creation. And these are also my teachers. I learn from them all the time. Another example of that, 43 Things. 43 Things is a site where you can go and put in 43 things you want to learn. You want to learn how to play guitar, you want to learn how to cook stromboli, you want to learn French. As soon as you do that, you're connected with everyone else in that universe who wants to learn the same thing as you do. So now you have 150 people who want to learn how to play guitar, and you have your own blog, you have your own community, you have your own network created for you automatically. You know the number one thing is that people want to learn on 43 Things? It's ironic. How to stop procrastinating. Social networks are huge in this environment. Social networks are huge because, basically, we are social creatures, and we want to connect around knowledge with each other. This slide, if it comes up, is basically a listing of all the social networks on Wikipedia right now. And MySpace is the big one, obviously, but it certainly isn't the only one. There are many, many other social networks out there. Let's see if we can start it from here. So we have listings of things like 43 Things, which is up there, Bebo, Dead Journal, eCademy, 7 million on Facebook, 29 million on Friendster. Let's see what MySpace is up to these days. They're probably close to 100 million people on MySpace at this point. There it is, 95 million people on MySpace at this point. So there are a lot of social networks, and this whole social kind of feel for education and for learning is something that we're just going to have to learn to deal with. Social research. Basically, dig.com is another place that the community decides what stories are important. And this is the technology piece of Dig, if this comes up. And so what happens is when there's news out there, the community will say, well, this is worthwhile, this isn't worthwhile. Dig allows you to collaboratively decide what information is most important for the community. So all of us decide what we should read, not just one particular person. There are others like Delicious. How many of you have Delicious accounts, which is a social bookmarking place, which allows you to basically, when you find things that you like, when you find interesting sites, that you can post them, and those sites connect with one another because of the tags that you put on there. Flickr is another example of this, and where social, again, it's the idea that we connect pictures socially. We put them together in ways that we haven't done in the past, and they can find each other. So if you went to NEC, any of you go to NEC this year? So if you notice, there was a whole Flickr photo set of pictures taken at NEC. There were over 1,500 of them. Actually, of people that had taken pictures and just put them up there so that people could see the types of things that people were looking at and experiencing. So the questions are, how do we best support students in an environment where it's, you know, they need to be self-directed and ubiquitous learners? And how do we re-envision classrooms to leverage the abundance of knowledge that we have? It's not scarcity anymore. It is abundance. It's something that we need to think about. You know, what do we do in a world where the sum of human knowledge is at our fingertips? It's definitely different from what we had before. The web changes texts. Obviously, this is the way textbooks still look for most of us and for many of us. But what it's starting to look like now is this, which, again, if you could see it, is the whole South African curriculum, high school curriculum, on a wiki. The whole thing. So basically, the idea is that if you're teaching physics, if you're a teacher who's teaching physics, you can go in and you can access the physics text that's there. And if you have other content or other ideas to add to it, you can do that. You can put your own ideas in there. And so it's an organically built physics text, kind of from the people who are using it most. And it's a very collaborative and shared space. Now, the WikiBooks is the organization that's putting this together. They have over 1,000 books that they're writing right now. And I'm wondering if textbook companies are probably sitting there kind of going, you know, what do we do in this particular world where teachers and students actually can start to create their own text? We can do that. We can use weblogs, wikis, websites, news, books, forums, P2P, podcasts, screencasts, all sorts of different types of content. It really is a rip, mix, and learn society, right? It's like we can take things from different spaces and put them together. This would have been a site at a Harvard H2O, it's called, and you put together a playlist. And basically what you can do is you can go and you can just aggregate and accumulate different content from different places on the web into a list and then pick out the ones you need when you need it. So I love that idea that the teacher is a DJ, right? That he or she can kind of control what happens with the content. It's not a linear kind of, here it is, here's step one, step two, step three. It's like the example that I have up here is one that has a whole listing of things from Martin Luther King. So if I want a speech, I can get the speech. If I want a video, I can click on the video and do that. If I want the blog, if I want whatever, I can go around and I can mix and match. I can create the way in which I impart the information because it's not just the fact that I have a textbook any longer. So the question is, how can we create or supplement our text to be more current and more relevant to our students? The web really changes teaching too. Teacher's connector now, right? I don't have to be the sole arbiter of knowledge in my classroom anymore. I can ask my kids to help me find information, to help me aggregate that information. One example of that is The Secret Life of Bees book, which I used early on in my curriculum. We were probably the first high school to use it in the country. And we set up a blog to kind of create the reader's discussion guide about that particular book. And I went to the publicist of the author, Sue Mon Kidd, and I said, do you think she would be willing to come in and work with my students in the blog? And after we went back and forth a couple times, she said, sure, she would do that. And so my students were not taught necessarily by me in terms of the reading of this book. They were taught by one another because what they were doing was working on a blog to answer different questions, but they were also taught by the author. What a concept. And they asked the author certain questions, and she wrote back a 2,300-word response to them that started out by saying basically something along the lines of, what a wonderful experience for me to watch your interpretations of my work. I have learned from you. My kids were blown away by that. And they learned things about where their characters came from, where the symbols came from, the themes of the book, from her mouth, not mine. It wasn't me saying, well, I think this is what it means. It was the author coming in and saying that. I had one of my journalists, who was mentored by a Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist from the Washington Post, who I happened to run into on the beach one day, just luckily. Our kids were playing together. I said, what do you do? He goes, I'm a reporter for the Post. And I was like, oh, that's really cool. And I just won the Pulitzer Prize. I was like, what? You're kidding. Would you mentor one of my students? I just connected them. That's it. I just connected them together. And Meredith learned more from him about journalism than she could ever learn from me, without question. My whole class learned more from the feedback and the insights that he had about her process than I could ever have done. And I was a journalism major in high school, in college, too. And Skype. I mean, if you haven't tried Skype, you need to try Skype. You can call all over the world for free now using Skype, which is like a voiceover. It's voiceover IP. It's internet telephone. And so you can literally call authors in the UK, or you can call scientists in Australia. I've even heard stories of people calling, you know, people in Antarctica. All you need is an internet connection. And you can bring those people into your classroom. You can record those things too, and then make podcasts out of them as well. And so it's just another way that we can connect. So the question is, when we have access to great expanses of content and billions of people, how can we re-envision teaching at that point? The web really changes curriculum, right? I think it's such an interesting little shift. We tell our kids, now hand in your homework tonight. What if we said to them, publish your homework tonight? Publish it. It's just a little bit of a difference, but what's the rest of that sentence? When you say hand it in, what are you really saying? Hand it in to me, right? To me. If you say publish it, you're saying publish it to the world, or to another audience, to a different audience. It's not about me. I take myself out of that equation. And we can get other people to assess, other people to collaborate or converse around those ideas that those kids are creating. So students can really teach as well. And this is a site from Darren Kirkpatrick in Canada. When it's a calculus class where he uses blogs. Most people think math blogs. Ooh, how does that work? But what he does is he has his students at the end of every day do a scribe post, it's called. And so they go in and they summarize the things that happen in class, and they also add their own information. They add their own ideas to it. And if I could show you, let's imagine now, a really long post where the student had taken the information from the day's class and then also added all sorts of links, all sorts of comments, all sorts of reflections. And basically what's happened is that his kids have become so competitive about these scribe posts that he's had to create a scribe post hall of fame as a wiki. And so he will have certain posts nominated to go into the wiki, and now there's a whole listing of them there. And it's great stuff. It's great stuff. Now, the really interesting thing about that is, though, these kids aren't really concerned about how many people within the class are reading it. What they want to know is, where are people outside of our class coming in from to read it? And so he has set up a way for them to check the stats, and they're coming from all over the world. All over the world. They're teaching people all over the world who want information about calculus, about the particular things that they're doing in that particular classroom. Now, certainly that's not Darren's intent originally, but that's a nice byproduct because it makes the kids, again, more interested in the content, more willing to go and put ideas or in their own ideas and information into it. And have you checked the iTunes K-12 podcast list lately? I mean, it's amazing. I mean, there are literally thousands of podcasts out there now that are created by kids. Bob Sprankle in Maine and Radio Willow Web in Omaha. I mean, kids are creating all sorts of interesting audio content and video content that is really designed to teach and designed to not just say, here's what I did today, but here's what it means, here's how it's important. And digital storytelling. This is a video from a guy, Marco Torres. If you haven't heard of Marco Torres, you need to Google him. He teaches at a inner-city school in Los Angeles and has done amazing things with these kids in terms of creating video and putting it up online, having film festivals, and creating all sorts of music videos and things like that, where the kids don't write that well and they don't express themselves that well in text, but in video it's powerful stuff. And so what's happening is it's another literacy for them. It's another way that they can get engaged with the content in the classroom. So we have audio casts, photos, videos, digital stories, screencasts, all that type of thing. So the question is, what needs to change when our students can publish to audiences far beyond our classrooms? How can we stop thinking about assignments as things to be assessed and start thinking about assignments as things to be shared, as things that can teach and can really get a much wider audience? Because now we can, right? That's the difference. Wasn't that possible just a couple years ago? Now it is. The web changes literacy. Obviously, do we teach our kids how to read Wikipedia? How many of you are teaching your kids how to read Wikipedia? Should you be? It's just a question. Maybe. Something you should consider, because they're going there. You know it. My favorite story about Wikipedia is the kid who had a report to do, an assignment, and he didn't really feel like doing it, so he did a really crummy job on it and posted it on Wikipedia and then sat back and watched as everybody came in and edited it and made it better. And then when it got to the point where he liked it, he took it down and handed it in. And the teacher found out. The teacher realized that he wasn't that good, you know. But our kids are using Wikipedia. Are we teaching them how to read Wikipedia? Are we teaching them how to read in hypertext environments? Because more and more of what they're doing is going into places where there are lots of links, lots of things to click on, lots of trails to follow. And we're not, I don't think, really considering how that changes reading, how that changes what they read. Similarly, it changes how they write. How many of you assign hypertext essays or stories? They're out there creating hypertext all the time. Who's teaching them how to do it? Who's teaching them how to do it well? Who's teaching them the power of links in a digital environment? We're not. We're not yet. And I think that we really need to think about doing that, because it does change it. I mean, that's the first page of my book. It's very linear. It's easy to read. But when you go to a Wikipedia page, it's got links all over the place. It's very difficult to read. And it does change writing. David Weinberger, another book, Small Pieces Loosely Joined. Great book if you want to, again, start thinking about some of these changes. On the net, documents and pages get their value to a large degree not from what they contain. Documents are not containers of information anymore. Documents are connectors and pointers to other places. So it's not what they hold, it's where they go. What a concept. It's a very interesting shift, again, that I don't think we're really thinking about. And kids are out there trying to figure out, trying to navigate an environment like that. And literacy is obviously editing. I don't know, you've probably seen this site, martinlutherking.org. If you Google Martin Luther King, this comes up third, I believe, on Google. And when you get there, you can't see it in the blue up there, but it says, attention students, take our MLK pop quiz. There's a little link down at the bottom here that says something along the lines of, hand out flyers at your school. So they're marketing this toward kids. And basically, it looks like a pretty reputable Martin Luther King site until you read on the left there where it says, their FBI bugs reportedly picked up 14 hours of party chatter, the clinking of glasses, and the sounds of illicit sex, including King's cries, I'm effing for God, and I'm not a Negro tonight. Okay, so if your student doesn't know how to get behind this site and figure out who put it up there and why they put it up there, that student is illiterate, as far as I'm concerned. We're illiterate if we can't figure out, we don't know how to do that. And it's not just this site. What happens when everybody gets a printing press? What happens in terms of the reliability of information and how we deal with all of that when anybody with access can start putting up information? This is a huge, huge issue. It's a huge literacy issue that we as teachers and educators probably aren't down that road very far either. And yet we need to start teaching our kids about this. This is, by the way, Stormfront, the White Aryan Nation that owns this. And if you went to easywhois.com, and you put in the URL, it will give you all the information about who owns it. And that's step number one to trying to figure out, to try to get behind that type of information. It's a serious issue. The literacy of networks, you know, because our kids are going to be working more and more in networked environments. Are we teaching them how to do that? Are we teaching them how to figure out who to trust within those networks? Who are your trusted sources? How do you evaluate those people? How do you do the deconstructive work that you need to do in order to figure out what people's motives and people's ideas, you know, and where they're coming from? It's crucial. So the question is, how do we define literacy in a world where we must not only know how to read and write, but to edit and create and to publish as well? The web changes computing. The web is now an application and a platform. Google Spreadsheets. Any of you using it yet? Okay. Thinkfree.org or thinkfree.com. Any of you using that? Free Word, free PowerPoint, free Excel. Online in a JavaScript environment. 1 gig of free space. You can have it. Jumpcut.com. I can upload my video and I can do just about anything I want to with it in terms of splitting it up and editing it and producing it. It's all online. It's all in the web. Those of you who went to NEC, maybe went to the open source booth where Steve Hargadon had set up basically a whole open source area with about 30-35 old IBM ThinkPads running P1 chips that had nothing on them but a web browser. Nothing but a web browser. No software. And was able to do just about anything he wanted because of all these applications that are now coming on the web. So, you know, we're not going to be loading much software onto our computers much longer. It's going to be running through the web. Right? And that's a change.
That's a great change for some people. For Bill Gates, it's probably not great. But that's a great change for a lot of people. So the question is, how can we use open source and open content to connect students more fully? And then finally, the web changes culture, right? Okay, so let's talk about MySpace for a second.
MySpace would be the 12th most populous country in the world right now. If it was a country, if it was a physical place.
They add 200 new accounts every minute. So somewhere in the neighborhood of 12,000 people will have added MySpace accounts in the time that I've been talking or will be talking today. 280,000 new accounts every day. Every day. Not going away. MySpace is not, you know, magically going to disappear tomorrow.
What I was hoping to do was to show you a pretty typical MySpace site. How many of you have been to MySpace and taken a look? Okay, so maybe I didn't need to do that. How many of you have a MySpace site, by the way? Good for you. And, you know, we are now really concerned about the MySpace thing. And I got to tell you, I, for one, am really happy that MySpace has kind of blown up in everyone's faces, because at least we're talking about it now. At least it's in our face, and we have to deal with it at this point. We have to start thinking about what MySpace represents. There are lots of kids out there, obviously, who are doing not-so-smart things on MySpace, taking pictures of themselves like this, or in the bathroom mirror in scantily clad clothes, and, you know, meeting people who they don't know, and all that type of stuff. But I got to tell you that only a third of MySpace members are adolescents, and there are lots of adults who are behaving badly on MySpace as well. In fact, if you look at some of the adult pages, it's really scary, the types of things that are going on there. But having said that, 99% of what you'll find on MySpace is really innocuous, and a lot of it is pretty good content. There are a million bands on MySpace right now, 1 million. It is a music sharing site that is unbelievable in terms of people being able to connect. And it is a social site for kids. There's a great essay that was done by Dana Boyd and Henry Jenkins of MIT. And they tried to think, they looked at it and they said, why is it that kids are gravitating to these social sites? Why is it that they're doing this? And what they came up with is basically, when we were growing up, or at least when I was growing up, I was able to say to my mom, you know, at 6 o'clock or after dinner, hey, I'm riding my bike to the park, I'll be home at 9. And she said, that's cool, you know, that's fine. Just, you know, make sure you don't stay out late, whatever. I have a 6 and 8 year old, I would never say that. Just stay out till 9, come home. You know, it doesn't matter what you're doing, but have fun. Right? We are not a society that allows our kids to socialize in those ways any longer, right or wrong. But so where are they doing it? They're doing it here. This is where they socialize. Kids don't email anymore, in case you haven't noticed. Kids don't like email. That's adult stuff. Kids do MySpace, IM, and text. That's what they do. That's the way they communicate, by and large. Email is an adult thing. So it's a change in culture. It's much, much different from what we do. And now it's very transparent and in our face. And if you imagine, if you were looking at this site that I was going to show you, which is filled with scantily clad pictures of women and boys in their, on the buddy lists that are, you know, have their pants down around to here, who are standing there like this, who are very buff. I know it's tough to look at me and imagine that. But anyway, think about that, right? And we ask ourselves, why? Well, I don't think it's that surprising, to be honest with you. I was going to show you. This is really too bad. I was going to show you a Coors Light commercial. Remember the Coors Light commercial about twins? Do you remember that one a few years ago, the Super Bowl commercial? Where basically it had a bunch of cheerleaders jumping around in little pom-poms and their little skirts flying up, and they had two twins, and the whole kind of idea here was that men are macho and play football, and then the girls just kind of bounce around and, you know, show skin and do the whole thing. And when you compare that to a MySpace site, it's not that much different. It's really not. And I wonder why we're so surprised. I mean, this is a society that objectifies women. This is a society that is constantly sending messages to my kids about what they're supposed to look like, how they're supposed to act. My daughter's had it up to here with me every time we're sitting there watching TV and a commercial comes on. I say, Tessa, just want you to know, that girl is not real. And she goes, I know, she's not now. It's even a test. She goes, I know, she's not real. But I think my hardest job in my life is going to be getting her specifically, and my son too, but her until she's 18, with some semblance of self-esteem in this environment. And so, you know, MySpace, I think, is an opportunity for us in a lot of ways to start teaching some of those things. You know, this is a quote from a girl in the New York Times, a college student in the New York Times, where she says, by checking out a guy's profile, you can actually get a feeling for who they are. Now think about that. She should not have graduated high school. She shouldn't have. Or at least somebody should have been there telling her, hey, you know what? That really hot-looking 21-year-old might be some 63-year-old, you know, balding, you know, whatever, somewhere. You don't know who those people are. You have no way of knowing who those people are. But no one's telling her that. No one is telling her that. No one's teaching her that. And yet, you know, and so we have lots of opportunities. You know, MySpace now, the cover of Wired magazine last month, Rupert Murdoch owns MySpace. And Rupert Murdoch is going to make a lot of money marketing on MySpace. He said, flat out, this is the best marketing opportunity I have ever had. And so you can, on your friends list now, have Old Spice, if you want. You can have a movie as your buddy. Now, who's talking to our kids about what that means? About the manipulation that's going on? I don't think there are a lot of us that are doing that. And this is, you know, it's not because we don't want, I don't think we get it yet. We don't understand what's happening yet. And the kids do, but their idea or their kind of perception of it is so skewed that, you know, it's very different from what reality is. So we really need to teach MySpace. We really do. I can understand why we block it, but MySpace should be in every curriculum, in every school in this country. Because if it's not, we're wasting a huge opportunity to teach kids about safety, number one, which they all need to understand. They all need to understand that they're creating the permanent record. Wes is right now creating his permanent record as he blogs. I'm creating my permanent record with every piece of content that I create and publish online. Right? That's my permanent record. Now, for me, and for Wes, you know, we have some other things on our permanent record that might mitigate our stupidity at times. But for kids, there's nothing else there. So that picture, when you're passed out after a beer party, that gets called up by the admissions officer at college, or gets called up by a job interview when you're going for a job, that's a problem. They're going to say, well, why were you doing that? And the kids are probably going to say, how'd you find that? Or, what are you doing looking at? Because no one's teaching. So safety, number one, but just media literacy, literacy of the types of images, the types of things that are coming down the road, it's a huge, huge opportunity to teach, and we're not doing it. And we also need to know it, though. We need to know it, right? You don't want your kid being taught to swim by someone who doesn't know how to swim, do you? Would you want that? You want the driver's ed instructor to not know how to drive? Well, I think you made a left. Yeah, I think you turned your signal. You know what I'm saying. Right? So there were about half a dozen of you that have MySpace accounts? Bravo. Good for you. And I think that we all should maybe think about getting MySpace accounts. And think about the types of social interactions that kids are doing. And teach them that. Because no one's teaching them. And we really can't be afraid of it, right? Because right now our response is to block it or to filter it. How many of you filter MySpace at your school? Any of you do not filter MySpace at your school? A couple of you. We take their cell phones away at the door. We tell them we can't use their cell phones, right? Well, we're afraid they might cheat on a test. Well, you know, what if a kid can find the answer to a test question on a cell phone, why not teach him how to use the cell phone? Right? Why not teach him how to make it a tool for learning? And why don't we ask better questions if that's the case? Why are my kids learning the 50 capitals? I don't know. I can understand. Yeah, standardized tests, right. Exactly. But I can understand 5-10 years ago why today I can't. So we block it, we filter it, we restrict it. We take the tools that they use out of their hands. And the result is schools are looking less and less like their real world. And we're really in danger of becoming irrelevant. Now, you may like Al Gore or not. I don't know. But I think what he says about the global warming issue, which I happen to believe in, but I mean, I now have a real mower, you know, one of those push mowers without a motor on it. And it's very inconvenient, I have to tell you. But it's a change that I feel like I have to make in my life in order to somehow ameliorate this issue, to help ameliorate this issue. And change really is inconvenient. It is inconvenient, isn't it? As a classroom teacher, right? I'm asking you to really think about changing a lot about what you do. And a lot of you are sitting there going, oh, I don't want to have to do that. Because it is inconvenient. We've got our stuff. Our stuff is ready. Right? But this is the inconvenient truth about education. 28% of our kids think schoolwork is meaningful. 28%. 21% think courses are interesting. 39% says school will be important to me later in life. What does that say? We're losing them. Right? We are losing them. And I really think that in this period right now, a lot of the reason we're losing them is because we're not teaching them using the tools that they are used to and using the methods and the ways in which they learn outside of the classroom. I don't know why this stuck with me. But I was just driving down the road. I got behind a bus one day, a school bus. Bus stopped. The girl got out, and she was just walking down her driveway with her cell phone, just texting. I'm going, that's it. You know, that's the way they work when they're not in school. But we say, take it away. 30% of ninth graders don't graduate high school in 4 years. 27% of adults over 25 have a college degree. That's it. We're not doing a great job. Okay, so here's the good news, right? Little trumpets in the background. The U.S. Department of Education at NEC actually is floating a new model. They're calling it School 2.0. And School 2.0, this one actually I think I can show you without having things blow up. That's School 2.0. I know you can't see it very well. I'm going to hone in on a little bit of it. But basically, School 2.0 understands that these technologies are in the fabric of their lives, and understands, I think, that in order for us to maintain our relevance with our kids, we have to make it a fabric of our lives. We have to be okay with kids IMing. We have to be able to IM them. We have to be able to let them do blogs and podcasts and those types of things to be socially networked. Up there, I don't know if you can see it. Teachers, the world is your classroom. Know that you don't have to have all the answers. What a concept. Take a lot of pressure off my shoulders. And students, how will you change the world? Your future job may not exist yet. So the key to your success is being a continuous learner. A continuous learner. You know, I love it. George Stevens says, we fire our kids every 18 weeks. Right? Physics, you got to see it. Here's your walking papers. Physics is done, or whatever it is. On that last day, that's it. They're done. Are our kids continuous learners when they leave our schools? Are they nomadic? Do they graze on knowledge? I don't know. I don't think so.
And then down the bottom, this is what gets me really excited, but I'm a geek. Thanks for the mentorship podcast. There's some things I'll apply in my class, and I can help you set up your blog. I haven't decided if that's the student talking to the teacher or the teacher talking to the student. But either way, the fact that blog is even mentioned in this diagram, right? I'm like, oh, yeehaw. This is a good thing. My students are learning languages from kids around the world. Talk about authentic learning. Right? We can do that. We can hook our Spanish kids up with Spanish kids and let them talk together and learn together. So we need to really embrace these changes. We really don't have a choice. It's not something that we can just let slide and say, well, this, you know, we're not going to change for whatever reason. Let's see if this comes up. It's probably going to break again, but I had the opportunity actually a couple months ago of talking to 49 or about 50 superintendents up in New York State. And I posted to my blog, I said, okay, so I have this group, captive audience, the doors are locked. What would you like me to say? What message from my community of ed bloggers would you like me to deliver to that particular group? And I got about 50 or so responses, 45 responses on my blog. But this one was from a principal of the Science Leadership Academy in Philadelphia, brand new school. His name is Chris Lehman. It's going to be in the Franklin Institute. It opens in September, and his wife is expecting on the day that school opens. Bad planning, Chris. And he is school 2.0. He is doing. And I keep kidding him. I said, no pressure now, Chris. You know, not that anyone's watching you try to do this. But he is. He is trying to integrate these tools and these technologies in ways that make them more relevant. So anyway, he posted on his blog the answer to that question, and I just want to read it to you because I think it's really powerful. He says, tell them that our schools have to change or die. Tell them that there are more and more people arguing that the classroom, the very thing that we spent our professional career in love with, is becoming obsolete. Tell them those people are right unless we learn to change. Tell them that our kids already have changed. Tell them that our kids need us to teach even more. Our kids have more access to a more varied level of information than ever before in human history, and our kids need us to teach them how to navigate that space now more than ever. Tell them that locking out the sites and tools of this new world our kids live in will render us irrelevant and useless when our students need us most. Tell them that this new world means that teaching skills, cognitive and metacognitive, is now more important than memorizing content. Tell them that the multiple choice test can't possibly measure the new skills our kids must master. Tell them that our students can be content producers now as much as content consumers. Tell them that many of our students know how to reach a larger audience more quickly than any school district memo could ever hope to. And tell them that our students need our help to make them understand how powerful that is. Tell them that we have the opportunity to use these tools to extend our reach far beyond our school walls, far past the hours of the school day. Tell them that we can build a 24/7, 365 school if we embrace the technologies our students are already using. Tell them that there are too many teachers using these tools already to think that our schools won't be affected by them. Tell them that it's unfair and unsustainable to think that the lone teacher using Yahoo groups and Hotmail accounts without explicit school support can make enough difference to create institutional change. Tell them that the change has to come from our schools using the tools as part of their mission and part of their infrastructure. Tell them that our students are already telling new stories, and tell them that it's time for our schools to do so as well. Tell them that this matters more than they are willing to admit. I think that is just so well articulated in terms of the types of things that we have to start thinking about. The types of ways that we have to start rethinking what we do because of this new environment. It really is different. It's very, very different. And if you don't believe me, ask any journalist that you've met recently or that you know. Look at businesses, look at politicians, look at the ways that all of those grounds are shifting underneath them as more and more content becomes accessible and as more and more people become a part of the conversation. So, I think that your goal or the thing you need to start thinking about as you maybe leave today or leave this conference or whatever else, is basically, you know, how can you be more imaginative about the things that you're doing in the classroom? And what's going to be your one red paperclip? What's going to be the one thing that you take right now and start to trade up for a classroom that's more well-connected, that has more opportunities for student learning, and that really expands beyond just the four walls that you're looking at? How are you going to get to that house where there's much more opportunity for students and much more opportunity for you as well? It's a difficult task, but it starts with one step.
And I wish you luck in that journey, and I hope you take it on, because our kids really need you to. Thank you very much.
Moving at the Speed of Creativity podcasts are independently produced and syndicated for a global audience by Wesley Fryer and are shared under a Creative Commons Attribution 2.5 license. Learn more at www.speedofcreativity.org.